The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Serra. On Monday, July 15th at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting at the downtown fire station in the council chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for the meeting agenda and how to attend online. On July 17th, the Downtown Parking Task Force will be meeting at 10 a.m. at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. They'll also meet virtually via Zoom. For details on how to join the meeting virtually, please see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, July 17th at 4 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board meeting will be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, July 17th at 5 p.m., the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Advisory Board will meet virtually at 5 p.m. For details on how to join, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, July 17th at 6:30 p.m., the Planning Commission will be conducting an online-only meeting. More information, including on how to join the meeting, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Thursday, July 18th at 4 p.m., there will be a City Council work session held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For more information on the meeting, including how to join it virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. And finally, on Saturday, July 20th, City Manager Mark Shepard will host Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. You can stop by and say hello and ask questions about your local government. Located at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. This program is heard Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. and repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. Living without shelter, myths and realities, is going to be the topic of discussion by a team of panelists on Wednesday, July 17th, from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the First Congregational Church, whose address is 4515 Southwest West Hills Road in Corvallis. This event is being co-sponsored by the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition's Housing Action Team and Unity Shelter. The public is invited to join Unity Shelter's staff and board members in a conversation about the reality of extreme poverty and the true crisis of housing in Corvallis and across our country. This educational panel will focus on the root causes of houselessness, address the myths and realities of living without shelter, and share the work of Unity Shelter and what they do in our community. The panel will also discuss ways that our community might engage in advocacy around true community wellness. Panelists include Sean Collins, who is the executive director of the Unity Shelter, Moksha Makma, who is a Unity Shelter board member and former staff, Jacob Burwell, who is a traditional health worker with Unity Shelter, and Reverend Jennifer Butler, who is a Unity Shelter board member. First Congregational Church is also the location of the Safe Camp Micro Shelter Village that is operated by Unity Shelter. Unity Shelter provides safe shelter through emergency and transitional housing to those in our community who have none. The Corvallis Sustainability Coalition is a network of more than 350 partner organizations and hundreds of volunteers. The mission of the group is to promote an ecologically, socially, and economically healthy city and county. If you'd like more information about this event, which is taking place July 17th, there's more information at sustainablecorvallis.org. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Kroll.
This is Explorin' Lauren, bringing you a local nature report. As the beating sun bakes the valley floor, opening cracks in the ancient clays and silts that the rivers left behind in their endless meandering, I found myself retreating to the eastern foothills of the Willamette Valley in search of cool waters and seclusion. Nestled in the hills near the town of Sweet Home, McDowell Creek County Park hosts a small tectonic fault system, which has resulted in a family of waterfalls, which cascade down through the 20-million-year-old sandstone bedrock towards the Saniam River. As I climbed through the shaded undergrowth, I was drawn to the constant misty breeze that is pushed away from the cliffs by the falls. In a lush, shady hollow carved out by water, deer ferns thrive on vertical rock walls that overlook the steep, verdant ravine. It's probably 10 to 15 degrees cooler here than even the forest floor only 50 feet away. A perfect oasis for those of a more amphibious nature. As I scramble along the boulders towards the cascade, a flash of reddish-orange and cream soars across my vision to my right, flailing through the air and landing on another rock nearby. There she is, a northern red-legged frog, keeping a safe distance from this large intruder. Within seconds, she is out of sight, scooting her way into a dark, mossy crevice. The northern red-legged frog, or Rana aurora in taxonomy, rarely if ever strays far from water, and these creatures can be found along wetlands and streams from coastal British Columbia to northern California. Outside of the breeding season, adults spend most of their time in moist sedges, brush, or logs along woodland streams or shady pond edges. They are the largest native frog species found in the state of Oregon, with females reaching up to 4 inches long, and they're listed as an Oregon Conservation Strategy species by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Those are species of greatest conservation need, whose study helps to focus efforts to restore and maintain habitats. Their long, powerful legs make them excellent at leaping long distances away from predators, as I just witnessed. Predators include snakes, birds, small mammals, and fish. Their long, sticky tongues are well adapted to catching mostly invertebrates as their prey, including insects, small snails, tadpoles and small fish, and even small frogs of other species. Like all frogs, their skin is an important and innate immune system organ, a first line of defense against pathogens in their environment. As Varga et al. Describe in their 2019 article on the topic, the mucus on frog skin comprises a chemical barrier which contains an antimicrobial peptide arsenal. They also have pattern recognition receptors which detect pathogens, plus commensal microbes that help with defense. In the young tadpole stage of their life, northern red-legged frogs are fully aquatic and feed on algae. In the late winter, as soon as temperatures reach about 45 degrees, they will gather in still waters to breed for about 1 to 2 weeks, each female laying about 2,000 eggs, which are attached to submerged plant stems. Males have a low-pitched, underwater mating call consisting of 5 to 7 notes, and it sounds like this. After the eggs hatch, tadpoles undergo a complete metamorphosis within about 16 weeks, developing legs and lungs and reabsorbing their tail. Individuals can live to be over 10 years old. The breeding season can be a perilous time for northern red-legged frogs that live near human settlements, as they cross busy roads to reach their breeding ponds. So watch out for these horny frogs crossing the roads during the late winter, especially after it rains. At least now we know why the frog crossed the road. Like many native amphibians, their historical range has contracted from habitat destruction and fragmentation. This is due to several factors, which include human development, logging, changing fire regimes, climate change, and predation from invasive species like the American bullfrog and non-native fish. After my brief encounter, I never did see this slippery specimen again that day, but I take comfort in knowing they're safe and cool during the scorching summer heat, nestled somewhere green and moist in the hills. As ecological stewards to the Willamette Valley bioregion, humans still have much work to do in protecting and maintaining biodiversity here, so that creatures like the northern red-legged frog thrive alongside us. More critical habitats like wetlands, prairies, and forests must be protected, restored, and connected as the 21st century progresses. More education and access to experiential learning in wild areas could foster an appreciation for the unbuilt environment, turning local residents into lifelong conservationists. If you own or manage property with streams or wetlands, you can help frogs and toads by leaving coarse, woody debris on the ground, encouraging native plant growth, and avoiding the use of pesticides and herbicides that could contaminate their habitats with runoff. For more data and information about northern red-legged frogs and all 12 of Oregon's native frogs and toads, you can visit myodfw.com. You can also review the Oregon Conservation Strategy at OregonConservationStrategy.org. This has been a KORC Nature Report.
It's going to be sunny throughout the day with highs near 90. Tonight we'll have clear skies with lows at 54 and winds from the northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour and the moon in its waxing gibbous phase. Tomorrow's going to be another sunny day with highs near 90. It's going to warm up to highs at 94 by Tuesday and cooling off to highs in the mid-80s by Wednesday. This is KORC.
This is Alex Huff. I'm a DJ for KORC, and I am from a small town about 40 minutes southeast of Corvallis named Brownsville. Brownsville is known by many as the Stand By Me town. It's one of several towns since the 1980s that has had the honor of representing Stephen King's iconic Castle Rock on the silver screen. Stand By Me was released in 1986 and takes place in 1959. It follows a two-day journey of four preteen friends, Gordon, Chris, Teddy, and Vern, who are trying to locate the body of a missing boy their age named Ray Brower. It's a bit dark, but also very funny and deeply touching. The boys are played by Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Corey Feldman, and Jerry O'Connell, all of whom went on to have successful careers.
We talked into the night. The kind of talk that seemed important until you discover girls.
All right. Mickey's a mouse. Donald's a duck. Pluto's a dog. What's Goofy? If I can only have one food for the rest of my life, that's easy. Pez. Cherry flavored Pez. No question about it.
Goofy's a dog. He's definitely a dog.
I knew the $64,000 question was fixed. There's no way anybody can know that much about opera. He can't be a dog. He wears a hat and drives a car. Wagon Train's a really cool show, but did you ever notice that they never get anywhere? They just keep wagon training.
God, that's weird. What the hell is Goofy?
Not one of us mentioned Ray Brower, but we were all thinking about him.
I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say it's remained one of the most loved films of all time. And Brownsville can prove it by the hundreds and some years even thousands of people from all over the world who come out to celebrate Stand By Me Day. While the film takes place over Labor Day weekend, Stand By Me Day happens every July 23rd. Brownsville was selected as a shooting location thanks to its 1950s ambiance, which remains largely the same to this day and really adds to the charm of this event, which began in 2007 and includes shooting location tours, character impersonators, and of course a pie eating contest. For those who have seen the film, you already know that the pie eating scene is among the most memorable.
Suddenly, Bardess opened his mouth, and before Bill Travis knew it, he was covered with five pies worth of used blueberries. The women in the audience screamed. Boss man Bob Cormier took one look at Bill Travis and barfed on Principal Wiggins. Principal Wiggins barfed on a lumberjack that was sitting next to him. Mayor Grundy barfed on his wife's tits. But when the smell hit the crowd, that's when Lardass' plan really started to work. Girlfriends barfed on boyfriends. Kids barfed on their parents. A fat lady barfed in her purse. The Donnelly twins barfed on each other. And the women's auxiliary barfed all over the benevolent order of antelopes. And Lardass just sat back and enjoyed what he created.
And speaking of creating things, I sat down with Stand By Me Day's event chair, Linda McCormick, at the Pioneer Picture Gallery in downtown Brownsville, just mere feet from the commemorative penny that is fused to the crosswalk as a nod to the scene where Vern excitedly finds a penny in the road. We immediately jumped into what to look forward to this year, as well as some of the highs and lows of keeping an event like this alive.
We have a penny embedded here where Vern stopped, and with that many fans, they stopped traffic.
I've heard about the controversial penny in the road.
Yeah, because they want their picture with it, and then more people come, and it's farming season. So we had big tractors going through yesterday that I was behind. So we actually have two guys that are going to take turns being crossing guards.
Oh, good.
And so they'll, you know, let traffic go, and then, okay, come on out. So it's just sort of hilarious that in this little teeny town, we have to find crossing guards, you know, but that's what it's about.
On the subject of fundraising, so like the marathon, we haven't had that every year because that takes a certain amount of fundraising. And then also showing the movie hasn't happened every year because of fundraising issues. Talk a little bit about that, because for an event so relatively successful, I know it's not, you know, Oregon Country Fair or anything, but it's pretty big for this town. I'm surprised that there isn't more funding.
Well, and that's the thing, because for every event in this town, we go begging.
Right.
You know, so most of them are pretty limited. We've had pretty good luck for the most part. I think this time, like, our hours are from 11 to 5, and we can't start the movie till like 9, 9:30, quarter to 10. So it's in the dark, you know, in the park. And again, you have to pay for copyright. That's, last time it was about $300, just to say it's legal. And then you need to find someone who has a big enough screen and the projector that'll, you know, work. So it's a fairly expensive thing to do. But we've renovated the rec center up here that's behind City Hall, and it's got a huge gym. And one of the things they want is a screen, because they have other uses for a screen. So I'm hoping next year that maybe we can do that, and we can show it ourselves with our own equipment, our own screen, and then we just need the money to get the copyright permission.
Right, and you could, you're not limited to after 9.
And exactly, you can play it any time of the day. So, and the Oregon Film Office has now created the Oregon Film Trail. They're building and building and building. I think Stand By Me was the first one on that. And you can go all over the state. We've got 3 signs where scenes were shot here in Brownsville, and one is in the park. They also work with a phone app called Set Jetters. You can put it on your phone, and anywhere in the world, you can open that app and say, is there a movie that was filmed near me, or how close, where was the nearest movie filmed? And they've got all kinds of information. You can take a picture, set it up on your camera, and it'll put you in a scene.
Oh, wow.
Through the camera, with you standing at that location. Or
that's incredible.
Like that. So, and we also have family games. We've got hula hoops, jacks. So.
Things that feel very 50s.
Yeah, yeah. And Caesar the No Drama Llama is decided to come and join us. The blueberry pie eating contest.
That'll
be
take
a three.
Three, yep.
Yep, I think we're starting sign-ups at 1 o'clock at our information booth. That'll be on the deck at Randy's Main Street Coffee at 3. And the Central Lynn Lions Club is putting that on.
Oh, okay.
And our local Pioneer Villa restaurant.
Oh, they're providing the pies?
They're providing the pies.
Oh, they have good pies, too.
I know. They're really good.
These are not cheap pies. These are good pies.
For smearing them all over your face, they're really good pies. Exactly. And then we have a pie booth. We're getting them from a Mennonite woman who makes wonderful blueberry pies.
Or you can just buy one.
So you can buy a slice. You don't have to put your face in it. And then we have the guy that has a tractor and he churns ice cream with the engine. He'll be there to put ice cream on your pie. We've got a couple of food trucks. One food truck is hoping to make something, we call it a Verno burger. So it's like hamburger in the shape of a hot dog.
Oh, funny.
So, and we've got a 50-50 raffle we're going to be doing. So about 4 o'clock, I think we'll pull the ticket for that. We've got guided walking tours all day long. We've got a choir that's kind of gathered and they've learned some of the songs and other 50s-ish
songs.
Oh, great. So they'll be wandering around town singing.
Because it's an iconic soundtrack.
It really is. And like I said, the food trucks, and we're hoping to get a number of old cars. When Gordy comes out the door of the store with his magazine, there's a brown pickup truck, and it still runs, and it lives here in Brownsville.
Oh, wow.
And so he's going to try to park it about where it was in the movie. I think where exactly it was is illegal right now, so he's going to get as close as he can. He has a picture from the film in his window. So people can stand out there, take a picture in front of the truck. A couple others we know of that I think are going to try to be here that were just in the film somewhere. You know, the fans love just those little tidbits.
Totally.
You know? Yeah.
Tell me more about this raffle. It's going to take place in front of the museum.
Yeah, so last year we had a lady who put together 4 boys and dressed them as close to looking like the boys in the movie. And so they're going to try to do that again this year. So they'll be selling the raffle tickets around town and taking pictures with you, with the 4 boys.
That's fun.
And then I think we'll have one of them draw the winning ticket for the 50-50 raffle.
And what do you get for that? What is
money.
Just money.
However much. Last year it was about $200.
Wow.
So we split it in half. We get half and you get half. The winner... The winning ticket gets half of the money we pulled.
Wow.
So.
And our, I'm wearing a Stand By Me shirt. I got this at the museum here. This was for the 30th anniversary,
there
though.
You go.
Are
yeah.
there new shirts, different shirts, or just these same ones from the
30th? We've got some different ones. I think the same ones we had last year and maybe the year before. The company that we got your shirt from, because it's a picture of Vern, and
it's
a picture out of the movie.
Yep. Do you want to see a dead body?
Do you want to see a dead body?
You guys want to go see a dead body?
We all understood what Vern meant right away.
The company we got that from, they had copyright permission to use scenes on their t-shirt. So we got 2 or 3 different ones, and they no longer are doing that.
Okay.
So we've had to do our own artwork.
There is a lot that goes into these small events that are big deal things. The copyright, the rights to even make a fun t-shirt. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't realize how difficult it is to be above board and to put on
to
an event like this.
Right, right. Well, and we've joked, you know, we're keeping that movie alive. You know, they should be paying us.
Right, yeah, but, you should be giving something, a medal or
not
something.
Not the way it works. I just ordered, in fact, a bunch of dog tags because Teddy had
his
dog tags. So we have a dog tag and it says Stand By Me Day, Brownsville, Oregon.
That's neat.
We've got combs that we've done.
Oh, Vern's combs.
You know, it's corny, but they love it. So.
Yeah. It's a very simple film, which is part of its beauty. And so you do remember all those little details of each character, the things they like. And, you know, there's only so many towns that have gotten to be a Castle Rock in cinema, and we're one of them.
Right. I tell people my defining moment for why am I doing this? Years ago, I had a guy here from Australia. And I was walking around showing him where some of the scenes were shot. And there's one where Gordy and Chris are walking downtown, and there's like an overhang with a post, you know, a cover over the sidewalk. And this guy went up and he put his hand on the post and he just said, "I've waited a long time to touch this post."
Wow.
And I'm like, really? So it's not just recognizing things, but, and I've talked to some and they feel like they are now part of the movie when they've been here. It's just not their favorite movie, but they're now a part of it, and it's touched their heart, touched their soul. I don't know. So when people say, "Why are you still doing this?" When you see the faces, you have fulfilled someone's dream. That's what keeps driving me, and seeing those smiles.
Well, yeah. Linda, thank you so much for keeping that magic in this town. It's always been magical growing up here and knowing it's the Stand By Me town. It's how other people from other towns refer to us.
Yeah, Castle Rock.
And we've really fully embraced that. And yeah. Not every town with a shooting location does that. So
exactly.
Thank you
exactly.
For your effort.
You're welcome.
And everyone, show up on the 23rd, July 23rd every year. And we've got some great events this year, so be sure to give the movie another watch if you need a refresher, or if you've never seen it, definitely you can rent it digitally. That's what I did last night. Come on out to Brownsville, Oregon.
That was Linda McCormick of Brownsville, event chair for Stand By Me Day, which takes place on July 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. I'm Alex Huff for KORC.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. The Corvallis City Council has adopted the 2024-2025 budget at a total of $270.58 million. This is the cost of operating the City of Corvallis. It is a $9.5 million increase from the previous year's budget. The increase is due to personnel costs, including wages and benefits. Around 7 full-time staff members are planned to be added by the city, a move that City Manager Mark Shepard says, quote, will help us address operational needs across the city. However much the increase assists some departments, others were left out of budget increase requests. Both Fire and Parks and Recreation requested increases totaling around $3 million, which were denied in the current budget. They had asked for a new medic unit, new positions, as well as minimum wage increases for casual staff at the Parks and Rec Department. Human resources is one of the city's main sources of expenditures. Some other additions to city staff include the following. The library will add 2 part-time positions to support the Friends of the Library, Library Foundation, and Volunteer Program, as well as branch operations. Parks and Recreation will add a new park ranger, an event coordinator, and convert 2 seasonal park workers to full-time maintenance staff. The Public Works and Finance departments will each fill 1 full-time equivalent position, a GIS data stewardship analyst and accountant, respectively. In the Information Technology Department, positions for an Enterprise Resource Planning Systems Administrator and an analyst position are funded. A summary of positions also include 1.25 full-time equivalent or FTE in the Community Development Department, 1 FTE in Finance Department, 1.25 FTE in the Human Resources Department, 2 FTE in the Information Technology Development, 1.38 FTE in the Library, and 1.2 FTE in the Parks and Recreation Department. According to the Gazette Times, in March, Finance Director James Inglis told the Budget Commission that with the pandemic behind and no looming recession, the city's revenues were stabilized and Corvallis was on track to meet its 2023-24 revenue goals. Property taxes are up 4%, transient lodging and other taxes are up 23.7%,
and increased city service fees approved by council last December will contribute toward a 10% increase in monies generated from licenses, fees, and permits. In related news, the council also adopted a resolution to switch from an annual to a biennial budget cycle, meaning that starting at the end of the current cycle, the council will consider the city's budget over a 24-month period rather than a 12-month approach, as has been the practice. The reason behind this, according to the resolution, is it, quote, will provide an opportunity for better long-range and strategic financial planning and consolidation of efforts vested in the budget development and approval process. Finance Department Director James Inglis said that while the shift will free up staff time to focus on other projects, the extended time could make budget forecasting more difficult. He also said, quote, "And then there's always a risk that the time savings you anticipate by going to biennial won't materialize." The council voted unanimously on the change. It's set to begin July of next year. Special thanks to the Gazette Times for some of the information provided here. You're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following story was published in the Gazette Times on July 11, 2024, and was written by Kimberly Chandler from the Associated Press. Headline, Milk, Eggs, and Bullets. Grocery stores in three states testing ammo vending machines. A company has installed computerized vending machines to sell ammunition in grocery stores in Alabama, Oklahoma, and Texas, allowing patrons to pick up bullets along with a gallon of milk. American Rounds said their machines use an identification scanner and facial recognition software to verify the purchaser's age and are as, quote, quick and easy, unquote, to use as a computer tablet. But advocates worry that selling bullets out of vending machines will lead to more shootings in the U.S., where gun violence killed at least 33 people on Independence Day alone. The company maintains the age verification technology means that the transactions are as secure or more secure than online sales, which may not require the purchaser to submit proof of age or at retail stores where there is a risk of shoplifting. Quote, "I'm very thankful for those who are taking the time to get to know us and not just making assumptions about what we're about," unquote. CEO Grant Majors said, quote, "We are very pro Second Amendment, but we are for responsible gun ownership, and we hope we're improving the environment for the community," unquote. There have been 15 mass killings involving a firearm so far in 2024, compared to 39 in 2023, according to a database maintained in a partnership of the Associated Press, USA Today, and Northeastern University. Quote, "Innovations that make ammunition sales more secure via facial recognition, age verification, and the tracking of serial sales are promising safety measures that belong in gun stores, not in the place where you buy your kids' milk," unquote, said Nick Cipollina, Senior Vice President for Law and Policy at Every Town for Gun Safety. Quote, "In a country awash in guns and ammo, where guns are the leading cause of death for kids, we don't need to further normalize the sale and promotion of these products," unquote. Majors said grocery stores and others approached the Texas-based company, which began in 2023, about the idea of selling ammunition through automated technology. The company has one machine in Alabama, four in Oklahoma, and one in Texas, with plans for another in Texas and one in Colorado in the coming weeks, he said. Quote, "People, I think, got shocked when they thought about the idea of selling ammo at a grocery store," unquote, Major said. Quote, "But as we explained, how is that any different than Walmart?" Unquote. Federal law requires a person to be 18 to buy shotgun and rifle ammunition, and 21 to buy handgun ammunition. Majors said their machines require a purchaser to be at least 21. The machine works by requiring a customer to scan their driver's license to validate that they are age 21 or older. The scan also checks that it is a valid license, he said. That is followed by a facial recognition scan to, quote, "you are who you are saying you are as a consumer," unquote. Quote, "at that point, you can complete your transaction of your product and you're off and going," unquote. He said, quote, "the whole experience takes a minute and a half once you're familiar with the machine," unquote. Last year, an online retailer settled a lawsuit brought by families of those killed and injured in a 2018 Texas high school shooting. The family said the 17-year-old shooter was able to buy ammunition from the retailer who failed to verify his age. Vending machines for bullets or other age-restricted materials is not an entirely new idea. Companies have developed similar technology to sell alcoholic beverages. A company has marketed automated kiosks to sell cannabis products in dispensaries in states where marijuana is legal. Majors said much of the early interest for the machines has been in rural communities where there may be fewer retailers that sell ammunition. The American Rounds machines are in Super C Mart and Fresh Value grocery stores in small cities, including Pell City, Alabama, which has a population over 13,000, and Noble, Oklahoma, where nearly 7,600 people live. Quote, "someone in that community might have to drive an hour or an hour and a half to get supplied if they want to go hunting, for instance. Our grocery stores, they wanted to be able to offer their customer another category that they felt like would be popular," Majors said. This story, Milk, Eggs, and Bullets, Grocery Stores in Three States Testing Ammo Vending Machines, was written by Kimberly Chandler from the Associated Press, dated July 11, 2024, and was in the Corvallis Gazette Times. You're listening to KORC. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics in a segment we call Community Voices. I got the opportunity to meet with musician David Rogers from Eugene, who is going to be playing his lute and guitar and many of his own compositions as well as covers of very popular songs at Cardwell Hill Cellars, which is in Philomath, on August 2nd at 6 o'clock. Tickets are available for $10 at the door. Let's hear what David Rogers had to say about his learning and how he got involved with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
Hi, everyone. This is JC, and I'm sitting with David Rogers, a local artist, musician, who I have a lot of questions for. How are you today, David?
I'm doing great.
Good. Tell our listeners a little bit about what you do.
I usually describe myself as a classical and jazz guitarist. I grew up in the Detroit area and came from a very musical family. My grandmother and mother were very good keyboard players and pianists. There's some things about the keyboard that I did finally learn, some keyboard, but I didn't like the mechanism of the keyboard that, you press a key down and then it activates a lever, and then that lever activates a hammer that strikes a string. And I had the mind for the chords and the polyphony, and I kind of drifted towards that. And I really liked that the guitar, you would pluck it with your fingers, or if you were playing with a pick, the player was holding it in their hand, and you know, actually manipulating the string and making the sound that way. And I like that. I think that kind of reads in the music too, that there's that close proximity. So I got into guitar, and later on lute and early instruments, historical instruments. I was in jazz kind of stuff. Later on, after I'd done the classical and the jazz stuff and gotten into that, I got into lute and early music quite a bit. That actually is what brought me to Oregon in the year, in 1992, I hired into the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland as a lutenist and viola da gamba player, kind of a bowed kind of instrument, kind of celloid. But I had that background in classical guitar and improvising the jazz things, etc. Yeah, I've been here since that time.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about your time in Ashland with the, you said Oregon Shakespeare?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about
okay.
what you did with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and just Shakespeare and the round and all of that.
Sure.
And playing that music.
Sure. So. I hired in as a lutenist. Primarily, I was playing lute and viola da gamba.
And this is at the Oregon Shakespeare?
Oregon Shakespeare Festival, okay. Yeah. And at that time, we were doing historical music and dance concerts, mainly around, Shakespeare era, Italian, French, and English, from... Generally, we aimed at like 1550 to 1650. It went along with the plays quite well. Gradually, we expanded. We would do other styles and genres and things like that. We always kept the early music thing going, the historical music, during my tenure there. And then we were... kind of lucky we won a recording contest, Early Music America, an arts organization in the country, had a competition for young performers.
Early
Music America.
Early Music America, okay.
Early Music America. And we won that competition, and we were able to do a couple discs for Dorian Recordings, which enabled us to travel quite a bit. And we played in Germany a couple times and throughout the States, playing at like chamber music presenters. Things like that. It was very nice. So we did that for a while.
How long did you do that? So
I was there for 18 years.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so this mm-hmm. was not a short stint in your life. This was a big chunk of your life that you were...
I could still be there around the year 2009? My wife had finished her PhD in linguistics 10 years prior and was offered a position at U of O. So I had been teaching at Southern Oregon University and being a performer at the Shakespeare Festival. And we just kind of decided that it would be a good opportunity for her. And you know, it had been 18 years in Ashland, and we were ready kind of for a change. So, you know, these days I'm mainly traveling and touring, and through all of that, I was always composing and doing improvisational music, etc. And actually, in a lot of early music, even, you know, like Renaissance through Mozart, through Beethoven, there's really a lot of opportunity for improvisation, and especially in Mozart, that, you know, that you're keeping those skills going. So I was kind of slowly, through those years, kind of getting back to what I was doing early on in Detroit, being primarily a classical guitarist. So these days I mainly do that. I travel what I usually describe is like a contemporary instrumental or contemporary classical program. And I'm pretty busy with that. I've got a very varied program. I do classical things, and yet I've got like arrangements of kind of flashy arrangements of some Rolling Stones and Leonard Cohen. Be playing a couple Leonard Cohen pieces at the Cardwell Hill concert. I'll be doing Hallelujah. That's been a big hit. And then a number of years ago, I did Sisters of Mercy. And, you know, you do have to, you know, cycle and recycle pieces. So I'm coming back to it. And that, you know, it resonates. And I like that people are still into it. Hallelujah has just always been, you know, a massive hit.
It's a classic.
I can never not.
Yeah.
Play it. There's right. Some pieces it's like, no, I have to play this all the time. So I do those things, and then, yeah, I always do a major J.S. Bach fugue. And then I've been doing more like 19th century music more recently. I'm doing a Mauro Giuliani variation set on the Harmonious Blacksmith tune that Giuliani was early 19th century in Handel, who wrote Harmonious Blacksmith. And that piece speaks to me a lot because my mom was always playing that on her harpsichord when we were growing up. I just kind of drilled into my brain.
That was part of my interview with guitarist and composer David Rogers, who lives in Eugene. I would like to offer some of his music for your listening pleasure. He generously donated 5 of his albums to KORC, and I'm going to play one of his original compositions, which is Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, from his album, The Lone Wild Bird. Thank you. Was local musician and composer David Rogers with his composition, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, from his album, The Lone Wild Bird. That song spoke to me, and I just had to feature it today. We're going to add a lot more of David's songs on the KORC library, and I'll be featuring them on my two shows, The Lost Cork, and the Saturday Lost and Found Cork. If you'd like to hear more of David's music, he will be at the Cardwell Hill Cellars and Winery in Philomath on August 2nd, playing classical guitar. Tickets are $10 at the door. And you're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Serra. On Monday, July 15th at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for the meeting agenda and how to attend online. On July 17th, the Downtown Parking Task Force will be meeting at 10 a.m., at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. They'll also meet virtually via Zoom. For For details on how to join the meeting virtually, please see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, July 17th at 4 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board meeting will be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, July 17th at 5 p.m., the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Advisory Board will meet virtually at 5 p.m. For details on how to join, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, July 17th at 6:30 p.m., the Planning Commission will be conducting an online-only meeting. More information, including on how to join the meeting, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Thursday, July 18th at 4 p.m., there will be a City Council work session held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For more information on the meeting, including how to join it virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. And finally, on Saturday, July 20th, City Manager Mark Shepard will host Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. You can stop by and say hello and ask questions about your local government. Located at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
Good afternoon. This is Mary Lou Hebner. Glad you could tune in today. I'm lucky enough that my driver stopped at this roadside fair. It's an attraction unlike something we've done all day. I've had to sit in the diner and listen to him complain. Luckily, we found us some musicians. There's a young man over here sitting to my left. To move slowly towards him, but I've got my microphone in position. And I'm going to play for you, or this band is going to play. Please tell us your name for the microphone.
We're called Pipe Dance.
We're going to play a slip jig for you. This is called the Snowy Path.
I apologize on behalf of the wind that's blowing. We are near the Oregon coast. Thank you, and take it away. Thank you. Bravo indeed. That was beautiful music recorded live at a roadside gathering at Artisan's Market in Lincoln City. This was recorded on June 14th with myself, Mary Lou Hepner. My husband stayed home today. Big surprise. And I was lucky enough to run into this musical gathering of fine musicians. I apologize for the wind. I did not bring my windscreen today. And I apologize for those loud trucks during the performance. The young man has something to prove. The only thing he proves is he needs the muffler. This is Mary Lou Hepner signing off for now.